brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Send me.
The Trident is the only device that signifies you and identifies you as a SEAL operator. Every day I earn my Trident, no matter where I'm at or what I'm doing, whether it's on the battlefield or on Liberty, I earn my Trident every day. We keep ourselves out of the limelight because of the mission that we do. It's for our own security, security of our teams, our teammates, and our families. When I saw the SEAL video and they showed some of the training, traveling the world, that's a job for me. That's a job I want to do. That is a challenge that I want to take. They said, how many start training, how many end training? I said, I want to be that part that's going to end training because that's the kind of challenge I want to get into. So philosophy starts with basic underwater demolition SEAL training, the BUDS program. That's the training you have to go to a SEAL team.
You're listening to the podcast, Send Me. Here with you now is host Jason Sweet.
What's the count, team leader?
What's the count?
Down! Keep going!
Hold it.
Try it! Keep going!
Brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Send Me. Send Me.
You're listening to SOCOM Athlete's podcast, Send Me. This is your host, Jason. Today we have the honor of bringing to you Kevin Beyer, U.S. Navy SEAL sniper, automatic weapons gunner, SEAL instructor. He's humble, a quiet professional, overall great human being, and family man. He just transitioned out of the SEAL teams after serving honorably as a Navy SEAL for over 10 years. We're excited to announce that Kevin's going to be one of our instructors at our upcoming Hell Day event in San Clemente, California. So if you're training for special operations in the Southern California region, come on out and meet myself and Kevin, as well as the rest of the instructors at the Basic Reconnaissance course at Hell Day this November 19th in San Clemente, California. We have the honor of yet again utilizing the Marine Corps' Basic Reconnaissance Course facilities at Camp Pendleton, California. These are some of the best facilities in the world. For more information on our Hell Day events, frequently asked questions, and registration, hop on over to the SOCOM Athlete website and navigate to the Hell Day subpage. On this podcast episode, we're going to interview Kevin, as well as bring on some of our listeners slash students at the end for some live Q&A. So stick around for the full episode. It just keeps getting better and better. Some quick shout outs. As the purpose of SOCOM Athlete exists to equip individuals, both mentally and physically, for the challenges of special operations training so they can accomplish their dreams. It's truly an honor for myself and the entire SOCOM Athlete community to see individuals continuously graduate their special operations training pipelines. Congratulations to our three studs who all graduated Navy Special Warfare pipelines recently. All three of them are listeners. You know who you are. I am proud of all three of you. To see where you've come from when you first came to the Hell Day to now graduating your pipelines, it's been years for all of you. Now that you've completed one journey, you'll start your next by going to your permanent duty station and getting ready for your first deployment. So this isn't the start, but it's only the beginning. A huge shout out to our former SOCOM Athlete student who just secured Hell Week in Navy BUDS Class 356. Him and his teammates that secured Hell Week will move on to BUDS Phase 2, which focuses on dive operations. A shout out to our three students that recently graduated Air Force Assessment and Selection. Two of them will move on with the PJ contract, as well as one of them with a combat control contract. For those that don't know, the way the Air Force does things nowadays, if you want to be a PJ, combat controller, special reconnaissance, you go through the Air Force Assessment and Selection course. Finishing the course does not guarantee the career field of your choice. You have to be a top performer, as well as get analyzed by the training curriculum and instructor staff and vectored into the career field that they feel is best for you and the needs of the Air Force. These three individuals will move on to pre-scuba training in the Air Force Combat Dive School for closed circuit and open circuit scuba training. On the Army side, congratulations to our two students who both recently secured Special Forces Assessment and Selection. They have moved on to the Q course. That's the Special Forces Qualification course. And lastly, congratulations to our stud from right here in our Northwest Florida group who recently graduated Air Force Combat Control School and earned his Scarlet Beret. He is now an Air Force Combat Controller and will PCS to Herbert Field Air Force Base, Florida, to the Special Tactics Training Squadron. Here's some awesome information for you about STTS. One of our first SOCOM athlete students, Diego, from over 4 years ago, is now an instructor at STTS. The current commander at STTS, Major Chris Walsh, Special Tactics Officer. He's been a guest on this podcast. He's also been an instructor at many of our Hell Day events. We look forward to having him out at our upcoming Destin Hell Day event this December. Now, without further delay, let's introduce this episode's guest and SOCOM athlete's newest instructor, Kevin Beyer. Until recently transitioning out of the Navy, Kevin was with SEAL Team 7, where he was trained as an automatic weapons gunner, a sniper, and reconnaissance team leader. After serving on two combat deployments to Iraq, Kevin had the honor of serving as a SEAL instructor with Tradet 3 for SDV-1, where he taught everything from VBSS to land warfare, close quarter battle, urban operations, you name it. While serving as an active duty SEAL, Kevin earned his bachelor's degree in strategic studies and defense analysis from Norwich University. We are honored and pumped up to have Kevin as a SOCOM athlete instructor and as our special guest for today's episode of SOCOM Athletes Podcast, Send Me. Kevin, my man, thank you for coming on the podcast. How are you doing today, brother?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thank you for having me.
So, Kevin, you were a SEAL at around age 19, and you just finished over a 10-year career. How long have you been out of the SEAL teams now, man?
So I've been out since April of 2022, so about 5 months, and then I did a six-month skill bridge before that.
So about 5 months now. How has that transition been for you to live the life of a SEAL and have that high energy, high operational tempo to go to focusing more on your family? Congratulations, by the way, on being a father of three and being in the workforce.
Yeah, honestly, I'm not going to lie. It's pretty tough. It's a pretty big shock going from the SEAL teams into the civilian side and business and different culture. But overall, it's been a good experience. I don't think anything will compare to being in a SEAL platoon. But I have three kids, ages 6, 3, and 11 months. Being a dad has probably been the greatest joy of my life thus far. So very thankful to be a father.
Well, it doesn't get any better than that, man. You accomplished your dreams. Now you have three beautiful children that you get to raise and help them accomplish their dreams. So, Kevin, how did this whole thing start for you? What made you want to join the Navy and become a SEAL in the first place?
Yeah, so as far back as I can remember, I always had this desire to serve my country and join the military. I didn't know at first that I was going to join the Navy and become a SEAL, but I always wanted to be an Army man or a Marine. And my grandpa actually went to Buzz and got hurt. And back then they didn't have the rollback land where they kind of help you get prepared for the next class and you just continue to train and heal. So he got pushed to the PT boat units, which is pre-SWIC in Vietnam era. So my grandpa was the one guy who really led me to want to become a SEAL.
Inspired by your grandpa who also served. This is a common pattern that I've seen from a lot of our guests that have come on the podcast. Someone in their life, usually a loved one, helped influence their decision to join the United States military and serve at the highest level. Before you joined, did you ever look into any other branches or was it always, I want to be a Navy SEAL?
At first, I almost joined the Marine Corps out of high school. I was playing high school football and they came to my school and had a little thing in the quad and I was all for it. And then, like I said, my grandpa, he told me, he's like, hey, you need to be a SEAL, look into it. So I looked it up and I just saw the type of missions they did and just how challenging it was. And I just thought it'd be the most rewarding career to have and a great accomplishment to achieve. And I went for it.
And to rewind a little bit, before you joined the Navy, you were playing team sports such as high school football. How do you feel these team sports prepared you for a course like BUDS, as well as later on being on the SEAL teams?
Yeah, definitely. I was never the best athlete. I was always athletic, but I wasn't the superhuman that a lot of people just assume about SEALs or special operations in general. But I had a strong work ethic and playing football, doing two-a-days, being part of a team and something bigger than yourself. It definitely helps prepare you.
Right. And you and I both being younger guys, when we enlisted, 19, 20, we really had to rely on those team sports to help us get through those experiences in selection and help us in our interaction with others, being competitive, taking wins, taking losses, being a part of the team, putting in work for the team, showing up early, leaving late, cleaning up equipment. There's just a lot of things that you learn from team sports and just sports in general, such as being coachable, learning skills, competing with those skills. And as Kevin said, you don't have to be the best athlete to make it in these special operations career fields. However, having experience in athletics and team sports can set you up for success big time. Kevin, for those of our listeners out there that maybe don't have any experience working as a team sports, anything like that, that are trying to work on their teamwork, selflessness, leadership before they go into the military, what advice would you have for them to help them improve on that?
Hey, if there's someone out there who's in that situation, I'd say meet up with guys or girls who are trying to do the same thing as you and start training, or reach out to SOCOM Athlete and do one of their courses. It's very important to learn to be selfless, and resiliency, like you said, is key. And you'll find out quickly that if you're a selfish person, this is probably not the community for you. And you can correct that. It takes time, but you can correct that. You can just become self-aware and focus on that.
Kevin, any advice for our listeners out there on what it takes to begin to develop a sense of selflessness?
I learned just by helping out my grandpa take care of horses and doing hard work, shoveling horse manure and just being out there in the hot sun, knowing that, hey, that horse needs me to take care of it. So that's kind of how I learned. But to go deeper in the selflessness and how important it is going into this community. So it'll stand out really quickly, the guys who are only thinking about themselves. And an example, you know, in Buds, they try to teach you team gear, your gear, and then you. And that's the order that you take care of your things, right? So you got to take care of your gear, because if you take care of your gear, it'll take care of you. And then the team gear, obviously, it's a bigger picture. So like in Buds, they'll use the boats for an example, and you'll want to decon the boats because that salt water will destroy them. And if that boat sinks out in the big Coronado surf, you guys are going to be in trouble. So that idea of taking care of the team stuff, then your stuff, and then you can go take a shower and take care of yourself, right? And then transferring that into the SEAL team. So we do some pretty intense training out in the desert for our land warfare blocks. And I can specifically remember this one time as a new guy. After a long night evolution, we're out there for hours, just putting out, carrying heavy gear, shooting a lot of ammo, having a blast, but it's super tough. You get back, and as an ADUB, automatic weapons gunner, the first thing you do is you go and you clean that gun so that you know that it's going to work for you the next time you need to use it. And we had some, and somehow they make it by, right? You get one of those guys that is selfish and goes straight to the showers, throws their gear away. And I don't know how they slip through the cracks, but it always happens. And that'll stand out. And you, the new guys looking up to that guy, they will not respect him. And it kind of just is a toxic environment, and you don't want to find yourself there. So you need to squash that early on.
So you mentioned you were an ADUB automatic weapons gunner. What'd your loadout look like, and what weapon system were you carrying?
Yeah, so we had the LKN on there. It was a Mark 48, and we'd carry about 500 rounds, 400 on our bodies, because each box is 100 rounds, and then one box in the gun. And then in your squad and fire team, you'd have guys carrying extra ammo for you. And you'll learn to see that it's pretty funny when you say getting low, that ammo boxes will just start flying your direction if they don't want to carry the weight.
Oh, yeah. They're carrying all that extra ammo for a reason. Here you go. So, Kevin, for a new guy on the team, being an automatic weapons gunner, sniper, those sound like pretty desirable positions. How does the Navy decide what your specialty is going to be on the SEAL teams? And do you have any say in that?
You don't really have much of a say, and there's not a lot that goes into it besides making sure they have a certain amount of qualifications per platoon and per team. So automatic weapon gunner, that is usually, unless you're a combat medic, so like an 18 Delta, that is your rite of passage as a new guy in a SEAL platoon, because it's the heaviest gun. It's the most work. You want to own that weapon system and don't let it own you. It's kind of a rite of passage, like I said. And then to become a sniper, you'll be very lucky to get sniper school as a new guy, but it does happen. And the basic, be able to be a sniper, you got to shoot expert rifle, which the majority of SEALs do. So that's not too hard to obtain. But like I said, it all just depends on the platoon and how many returning snipers they have. That'll give them how many slots that they can send guys to sniper school and whatnot.
Gotta love being a new guy. So even before that, Kevin, let's rewind. In order to become a SEAL and get assigned to a SEAL team, you very early on in your training have to earn the rite of passage through BUDS. So how was BUDS and Hell Week for you, Kevin?
BUDS was pretty intense. I'm not going to lie. Started 19 years old, turned 20, joined at 19. So I think I was 20 years old when I was going through, which I think being young, you kind of have an advantage, just by not being really set in your own ways yet. You're kind of still learning and you're still looking for mentors to kind of lead you in the right direction, right? So I feel like in BUDS and in the early SEAL teams, I grew up a lot. I would say I was still a child when I joined. A lot of people always say, like, this is the workout you need to do and all that, which is very true. You need to be in BUDS shape. You can't just show up to BUDS out of shape and think you're going to make it through, right? But it's really the resiliency you were talking about earlier and your mindset and not even thinking that quitting is an option. I think that's huge.
Well said, Kevin. If we're focused on never quit, never quit, never quit, then that makes it an option. It's on the front of our mind. Instead of not even allowing that to be an option and staying focused on success and accomplishing the mission, you don't even think about quitting. It's not even an option. So, Kevin, how did you prepare for BUDS? You obviously graduated. What you did worked. We talked about team sports a little bit. What else besides that?
Yeah, so when I was training for BUDS, I do a lot of long, slow distance runs because I knew we'd be running a lot, and I would do them in combat boots just because I knew that's what I was going to be using in BUDS. I did a lot of pull-ups, a lot of swimming in the pool, practicing combat side stroke. For me, I grew up going to the beach a lot. I grew up in Southern California, but I was never a swimmer or water polo player. So it's really important to get in the pool and learn those techniques before you show up to your first PST. Swimming in the pool, running long distance in the sand with boots, pull-ups, push-ups, all the stuff you know that you're going to be doing when you show up to BUDS. I was working two jobs at the time, so I wasn't able to just spend the whole day training. But I would get a solid five-mile run in probably 2 to 3 times a week. And I wasn't too worried about the time. I was more worried about just not stopping, not taking any breaks, like pushing myself all the way till that run was over with, which ended up, it helped out a lot when I went to do my PSTs, because as some of the listeners may be aware of, you got to get elevated scores to be competitive. So you can't just meet the bottom requirements. But for swim wise, that my first PST swim, I think I got 18 minutes. I showed up in board shorts, had no idea what combat side stroke was. I looked probably like a clown. And then I learned combat side stroke, went there with some UDT shorts that I bought. Some guys wear Speedos if you're into that. And then my time went all the way down to like 8 minutes and 45 seconds. Almost cut it in half.
Well, that's a great story. You cut the swim time down quite a bit. And overall, you don't have to be the fastest guy at everything. You just have to be solid, right? And Kevin, when it comes to BUDS, we've had a lot of students be successful and get through the course, and a lot of students not be successful, get through the course. We had a guy secure this last Hell Week in class 356. When it comes to Hell Week, it seems that, and what I hear time and time again from my students that go through the course, is that the boats on heads evolutions during Hell Week are among the most challenging physically, that break a lot of guys. So Kevin, do you have any advice for our listeners out there on how they can prepare their bodies for something like the brutality of BUDS and boats on heads during Hell Week?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're not going to be able to replicate that, right? You're not going to be able to train your head to be dealing with that pain. But what you can do is do something extremely difficult and challenge yourself so that you know that you're mentally tough enough to withstand that evolution. Because when you get running under that boat and you're in the two spot, which is the middle spot where all the weight is, it feels like your neck's going to break, right? You just have so much weight on you. But if you're mentally tough enough, just continue and push through. So by doing maybe some long distance, either ruck runs or just a weight vest, and when it's a little hot, obviously get hydrated. Don't need to get hurt, but push yourself past your comfort zone and do it. I would say if you're trying to get ready to go to Buds, I would do it every day. Do one thing every day that's going to put you out of your comfort zone, that's going to make you dig deep and test how resilient you are. And that's one way you can get ready for both on edge.
Hey, that's well said. And some general advice, when it comes down to accomplishing your hardest training task each day, get it done first thing in the morning, right after you wake up. That way, you've already knocked out your greatest challenge mentally, physically, and you have that momentum and that victory moving forward for the rest of your day. Whether it be just getting out and running, or getting to the pool and working on your water confidence, pushing yourself past that comfort zone, get it done early, get it done first. You're looking at 10, 12 plus hour days during special operations selection courses, such as BUDS, as Kevin and I are talking about. During these days, a lot of it is physical training, whether it be running multiple times, swimming, calisthenics, you guys get it. So don't think that you can prepare your body for something like that if you're only running once a day. If you're serious about your training, you'll be running around 5 days a week, and roughly three of those 5 days, you'll be running twice in that day. It's not about just getting minimum standards on your fitness test. It's about being the most well-rounded, prepared individual that you can before you go to selection. What are your thoughts on that, Kev?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Jason. Definitely focus on your weaknesses and identify them. A lot of people tend to avoid the things that they're not very good at, and you'll see real quick that that's just going to make it worse for you. Definitely focus on those things that you know that you're not the best at so that you can get better. And when you actually hit it full speed live in BUDS, you know that you're going to be able to succeed.
Right. And the personality type of an individual that's going to be successful in the special operations community is somebody who takes weaknesses and puts so much focus on them that those weaknesses over time become strengths. Kevin, as I'm sure you've seen and heard recently, the New York Times dropped an article placing the SEAL community in the negative spotlight. This was following the death of Seaman Kyle Mullen, who passed away after securing Hell Week recently. This article made claims from everything to the students weren't getting enough medical attention, to the culture at BUDS was toxic, to rampant steroid use, you name it. Kevin, you're a guy who just spent over a decade on the SEAL teams. What are your thoughts on this article and its claims?
I did hear about it, and I did read most of it. I've got a little bit of mixed feelings towards it. Obviously, losing someone in training is probably, you know, the worst and saddest thing possible. When we go to war and whatnot, and if you listen out there, that's terrible too, but you know what you're getting into. And in training, that's somewhere where we got to make sure that that's not happening. They're pretty good now that if you have good peer evals, you're a good dude and you work hard. If you get physically hurt, like, you will get rolled and you will get another chance. And depending on what it is, they may give you an additional role if you're a really good guy. So focus on being selfless and doing your best and taking care of your team, and the instructors will notice that stuff.
To address the medical piece, PJ Indoc, Navy SEAL BUDS, extremely similar courses, very similar dropout rates, similar in length. PJ Indoc, short for Pararescue Indoctrination, was the primary course that was used to screen and select pararescue trainees for the past 60 years. The Air Force recently got rid of the course and implemented assessment and selection due to many reasons, but most of those because PJ Indoc had many training deaths over the years, as well as a very high attrition rate. And the way it goes at these selection courses is that if you're feeling sick, you have access to a doctor basically at all times. However, you have to remove yourself from training. And if you miss training evolutions, you either get recycled or rolled back to the next class if you're lucky, or you get dropped from the course. So there's a cost-benefit analysis of risk and reward for removing yourself from training to go see sick call. A lot of guys don't want to do it. And because of that competitive drive to stay in the course and press forward, many students are either hurt or injured while going through selection courses. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin?
Yeah, definitely. I think there were a few times where I did go through an incident where my knee was really hurting. A certain instructor didn't believe it, so then I continued on to the next evolution, and I made it through. But then when we had a run the next morning, a timed evolution, I failed that evolution, and it kind of bit me in the back, right? And if I would have went to sick call, you know, I probably would have got it checked out and maybe would have been given a break there. But I think it's just tough as an instructor to figure out, you know, which people are actually hurt versus people who are trying to get out of evolutions and kind of be that turd, right? That I'm sure a lot of people have heard that. It's even in the New York Times article, the guys who are, you know, selfish, only thinking about themselves and trying to get out of things.
Right. That's a great point. There'll be individuals at selection that want to quit, but they have too much pride and ego to do it. So they will fake an injury or go to sick call so that they don't actually have to say, I quit, and kind of put their fate in the system to see what happens next. But there's a difference between being hurt and being injured. Being hurt means you can still compete. Being injured means you have some type of debilitating condition that is keeping you from being able to compete. Instructors are not medics, and students are not getting evaluated by medics on a daily basis. So unless there is a very serious injury that's very obvious, it's on the discretion of the student to report serious injuries and medical conditions, because the type of individual we're looking for in the special operations community is someone that can complete a mission at all costs, whether injured or shot up, or it's extremely hot outside or extremely cold, or whatever the environmental conditions may be. You get the mission done anytime, anywhere. So going back to the article, it's easy for individuals, especially those outside of our community, to complain about things. But when it comes to solutions, now that's not so easy. Imagine if it buds every time a student coughed, an instructor had to remove them from training because they could potentially be sick. You'd lose half or if not all of the team. So really what it comes down to is students perhaps need to be more aware of the medical conditions that are there, what the symptoms may be like, and when to report them and when to potentially remove themselves from training. But again, you can't expect somebody to know what pneumonia feels like if they've never had pneumonia before. So this is a tough issue. And special operations selection courses, for the most part, especially BUDS and PJ Indoc, has always been under attack for being too challenging, too dangerous, not getting enough students through, and tragically, training deaths over the years. Kevin, would enjoy hearing more of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely right. And it's understandable to not want to get rolled, because for one, you're with these guys since boot camp. Sometimes some of the guys you even trained with prior to joining, and you don't want to get rolled and not be with those guys. But as someone who has been rolled myself, you will make new brothers in that next class, and you'll learn from it and you'll get better from it and you'll make the right choice. I'm not saying it's the right choice for everybody, but it was the right choice for me. And usually when you get rolled, for me, I had a performance role because of the runs, right? Because of a knee injury that I wanted to seek medical attention for. Didn't get to see it. got rolled, and they gave me a board where they look at peer evals. They hear your side of the story, and it's usually some older, like, master chiefs on the board, and you'll have that chance to explain to them your situation, right? And as long as you're in the right and your peer evals are good, they granted me a medical role, which would have been a performance role. So it definitely benefited me in the long run. I got the physical therapy that I needed and came back and didn't fail any runs. So
that's awesome, Kev. It worked out for you. You got rolled, you got back in the fight, pressed forward, got the mission done. So to go back to the article, there was also claims of rampant performance-enhancing drugs use at Buds, as well as a toxic culture. What are your thoughts on that as far as performance-enhancing drugs and the culture at Buds as a whole?
They put a bad taste in my mouth talking about drug use and how it's a problem in Buds and the SEALs. And there was absolutely nobody doing any of that stuff when I went through Buds. And obviously things change. Certain decades may have different cultures and different things going on. But something I can tell the listeners is don't get involved in that stuff. You don't need it. There's no reason to do steroids. It's just not worth it. If you're eating right and meal planning, like you said, you're not going to need all these extra supplements. It's kind of just something I believe people build up in their head, like, oh, they need this to get through. But you'd be surprised what your body can do with a little mental toughness and getting some decent rest and recovery and some solid meals. I don't think there's a culture issue at all. I think that our country as a whole and the military as a whole right now is kind of heading down the wrong direction of what it really means to be a warrior and to be dominant. The big thing that I see that I'm not liking is they're focusing more on woke stuff and things that aren't really pertaining to war fighting and less on being lethal and portraying dominance, right? Like half the battle is getting our adversaries to not even think about trying something with us. And just right now with the way we're going, it's not looking too good. It is kind of scary if you've seen a lot of the, and it's all propaganda obviously, but a lot of the videos of like China and their military training and Russia. And then you look at our latest ads for recruitment and it's like a cartoon talking about equality and all this stuff. And it seems like we're focusing more on things that aren't going to keep us safe as a country just to please some people's feelings, which I'm sorry, but it's not about people's feelings. The military shouldn't care about your feelings. The culture is to teach you like life and war, like stuff is unfair, right? So there'll be times where you worked super hard on getting your uniform ready for this inspection. You cleaned your room to the T. You mopped it, you did your Febreze scent and all this stuff. And you're like, there's no way I'm going to fail this inspection. And the instructors fail you and beat you anyway. You got to realize there's a reason to it. And you can't sit there and get butthurt and get angry. You're just wasting energy. Take the punishment and push forward. And I think it's part of the big plan, just to prepare you for going down range. And war is not fair. The whole saying, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. I think that's a general phrase that gets thrown around, and it doesn't mean you cheat everything, right? Because you need to be able to meet the standard. And if you're cheating and not doing the full workout or not meeting the standard, then that's wrong. But if you can find little loopholes here and there where you're not cheating yourself, you're not cheating your teammates, but you might be tricking the instructor staff a little bit, on something like you've been getting beat during this workout and they keep saying go get wet and sandy, right? You run down to the surf zone, get wet and sandy, come all the way back, and someone decided to not do it all the way. Like that's not the right kind of cheating, right? That's what's going to cause attention. You're going to get beat even more. But if you can find a way to be more efficient at something, you can take that route.
Right. And for people outside of our community looking in, when they see a phrase like, if you're not cheating, you're not trying, that's used at Buds, and then they say, well, this phrase basically justifies individuals to use performance-enhancing drugs. That's the culture at Buds. If you're not cheating, you're not trying, right? Whereas this phrase is much more metaphorical to thinking outside of the box. Innovating new methods and processes for beating the instructors, getting through the day, segmenting the challenge of each evolution to make it more doable mentally, physically. Think outside of the box. Be creative, innovate new ways for success. This is what makes a special operator special. In going back into the culture as a whole, it seems that whenever there's an issue on the SEAL teams, or for me, on the PJ teams, a high-ranking officer outside of our community would come down to the unit and do what we call a shakedown. You guys have long hair? You need to get haircuts. You have non-unit patches? You need to get rid of those patches. Unit patches only. In your team room, you have a calendar of a girl with a bikini on it over in the corner. That needs to go. And we're going to check out the entire squadron to make sure nothing like this is on the walls as well. And we also noticed that you PJs wear four different badges. Flight wings, airborne wings, your scuba bubble, and your halo wings. Air Force regulations state only two badges. So we want every PJ at this team to only wear two badges. Standardize, figure out which ones you want. So it ends up being punishment, disciplinary action. The whole team is on thin ice. Guys are upset. There isn't really any fixing going on of the problem. And we have tons of listeners right now that are former students of ours now in the pipeline. Whether you're in the SEAL pipeline or the Green Beret pipeline, PJ pipeline. When I went through and when you're going through, it was the same thing too. If one of your teammates got in trouble, the entire unit, maybe multiple teams, are now restricted to base for the weekend. Nobody gets to leave base. So again, you see this type of disciplinary action taken at the lowest level in the special operations community. There's not a whole lot of fixing. It's just all disciplinary action. What are your thoughts on that, Kev? I'm sure there's been one or two times in your career where you've dealt with a shakedown.
I think it was 2019, possibly, or 2018, but basically the head of WARCOM wanted to get good order and discipline back in line. The idea was to remove all platoon logos and patches, and that obviously frustrated a lot of team guys because some of those patches and platoon logos go back many different generations of in platoons, right? And there's so much history and brotherhood and older guys passing down to the new guys their patch when they've earned it and telling stories about maybe some of the brothers that they lost. And then you just go and say, oh, because I want good order in this one, we're going to get rid of these platoon patches. They're not authorized. Only team patches are authorized. And it just seems like it's a knee-jerk reaction by leadership that they think is going to help fix a good order and discipline problem, but really you're just gonna piss off everybody and they're not gonna respect you for it, and it's kind of counterproductive, right? I'm not against having certain designs be approved, right? Like you said, if it's a military patch and you're going out and you're representing the military and the U.S. military and there's other people there that might be civilians, yeah, there should be kind of what's appropriate, right, as a professional unit. But at the same time, most of those patches could easily have gotten just looked at and like, yeah, that's appropriate, approved, you know, instead of just banning them all and pissing off a lot of people and disregarding the history and camaraderie that's involved with that.
And Kevin, to go back real quick, you mentioned the word standards. Would you mind elaborating on why having an elite standard to get into the special operations community is necessary and why it's important to you?
Yeah, so standards are extremely important to me because, you know, as a SEAL, the reason why you're so close and tight-knit with your platoon is because you can trust that guy next to you, because whether he was with you all from the beginning of training or you just met him in this platoon or whatnot, you know what they've been through, you know what they're capable of, and you know that you can trust them to have your back, right? And you know that they're not just going to quit on you. And that's extremely important when your nation is asking you to do some of the toughest missions in the world and most dangerous, that you know you're with the guys to your right and left, or girls someday, that are going to be there and protect you and make sure you get home safe.
Well said. And when it comes to standards for a Special Operations Selection course, becoming a Navy SEAL is arguably one of the most challenging in the world. You secured Hell Week, graduated BUDS, graduated SQT, got assigned to a SEAL team, and then it all began. So what was it like for you at that point when you finally got stationed on a SEAL team over at SEAL Team 7, San Diego, California, West Coast?
It was an amazing experience, honestly. Like, you work so hard and you just keep pushing through, keep taking that next obstacle, the next goal. Lots of people say, you know, getting through Hell Week's big, right? And then the next big wicket is getting through pool comp, you know, and then finishing the island, graduating BUDS, and then getting through SKT, getting through CQC, close quarters combat training. And then you finally make it to that platoon and you're all excited and whatnot. And then you're back down to just being a new guy, which is fine, because as long as you have a good platoon and some solid new guys, you're going to learn even more. And, you know, you finally got to that spot, but it ain't over yet. A motto in the SEAL team is earn your trident every day. It's part of the SEAL code. And it's true. Like, every day, like, you got to earn that trident. Just because you made it through the training and you went to this platoon, now you're a SEAL and you're hot stuff. Like, no, you earn that every day. And some advice that I can give to new team guys, new guys in platoons. And this is something when I was an instructor out in Hawaii, I would tell the new guys that I was instructing at the ADEB courses, always keep this new guy mentality. And the new guy mentality should be, you know, you're always prepared with the right gear at the right time, usually early. Always be writing stuff down, have a notebook. When your chief or your older, more experienced guys are talking about something or doing a debrief, you better be taking notes, and always be selfless, right? You got to maintain that selflessness, because your older guys will be the first ones to call you out if they see you feeling sorry for yourself or trying to take care of yourself before you take care of the team gear and your gear, right? So maintain that. And then when you become an older guy, keep that mindset. Right? Earn your trident every day. Don't think, oh, because you have all these new guys under you, that you should just not do any work. Like, absolutely not. You should be out there just as long as the new guys are, cleaning boats, cleaning weapons. When you get back from deployment, sometimes some platoons will think, like, hey, let's just send all the new guys to clean all the guns and we'll go home. Absolutely not. Like, your mindset should be, we're all going to do this. This is all of our gear, not just the new guys. Let's clean this gear. Let's get it done as a team. And that'll just create a much better environment and culture inside that platoon.
I agree 100%. That's a great point regarding the new guy concept. And speaking of new guy, when you get to your team, the first question you should ask yourself is, how can I be an asset to this team? Because during the training pipeline, up until you finally get assigned to your unit, you're basically told what to do every day. Once you get to your team, you have a lot of freedom. And the dynamics of the team allow you to choose your schedule to some degree. So choose to be selfless. Choose to be somebody who is going to add value to your team at all times. So Kevin, as a PJ, the day-to-day for us was extremely dynamic, very busy. As a new guy for me, there were plenty of opportunities to be an asset and take care of my team, whether it be something simple like staying proactive and organized with your upgrade training to make your supervisor's life easier, or understanding that being fresh out of the pipeline, there's certain skills and education that's very fresh to you that may be outdated and not so fresh to other members of your team. They're more focused on leadership and planning, organization, logistics, administrative tasks, etc. So those older guys on the team, the senior enlisted, some of the officers, senior officers, they rely on young guys to be the subject matter experts on all of the skills that are required for the job. What was the day-to-day for you like, Kevin?
It all just depends on, you know, where you're at. So if you're in a platoon, you have your work up, right? So you got ProDev, which is a span of, I think, about 6 or so months where most of the guys are going to their schools, right? So like sniper school, breacher school, JTAC school, all those things. And if you're not out of school, you'll probably be doing some SOP development. You'll be coming into the team building, getting gear issue before you start workup. So all the comms, supply, the armory, right? Getting all the weapons. So it won't be too crazy in ProDev. That's kind of like your downtime, but you still get to go do some cool schools and whatnot, but you're prepping for that big workup. And then during workup, yeah, it's extremely busy. I wouldn't plan anything during your workup that's important. Like, I would not get married during workup at all. I would focus on just being there and getting the good training in, because you'll have some really long hours. Sometimes you'll just work all day and super late into the night, get a few hours of sleep, and then hit it again in the morning, just prepping for that next evolution. Then once that workup's over with, they call it something different every time, but I think we called it SIT the last time I was there. I don't even know what the acronym stands for, but you're basically sitting and waiting to deploy. And that's when you'll kind of do your more specific final battle problem type training. So depending on what AO you're going to get deployed to, they're going to send you to do very specific specialized training, more like your deployment, big final training exercises and whatnot. And then you get a little bit of a break, some pre-deployment leave, and then you deploy. And when you're on deployment, you know, that's deployment life. And then you come back and it kind of just all resets.
So, Kevin, we only have a few minutes left until we transition over to live Q&A. What was your favorite part about being a SEAL?
The quality of guys that I was able to meet and be around and learn from. And a lot of them probably don't even realize like how much they taught me when I was going through. Yeah, I think the friends that I made, the brothers I made, and the stuff that I learned, very thankful for. So just being with those kind of people, that high caliber of man, very thankful for. I really enjoyed being an A-dub, but you can't do that forever, because as you start getting experience, you got to do other roles like fire team leader, squad leader, actually making tactical decisions out in the battlefield, right? So during training, the most experienced guys, they got to be heads up and paying attention. You can't be sucked into this automatic weapon. But that was one of my favorites, was being an A-dub. It was just a lot of fun, very exhilarating. And then I was also a sniper, so I really enjoyed being a sniper. It's something that you got to always continue to work at, and it's definitely perishable. I haven't got on a bullet action in a while, so I'm probably pretty rusty right now, but it's amazing like how good you can and accurate you can get if you pursue your craft, you know, and you take it to the next level, which the teams will allow you to do that. They'll send you to specialized schools after sniper school. They'll send you to sustainment courses where they just make sure you continue to fine tune your craft.
Hey, thanks, Kevin. We'll go ahead and get into the live Q&A now with the SOCOM athlete students and our listeners. But first, I just want to say thanks again for opening up and sharing your personal experiences, your thoughts from when you were on the SEAL teams, man.
Sounds good. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. For our listeners out there, we're going to do some live question and answer with Kevin, as well as members of our SOCOM athlete group chats, who are all listeners of our podcast. They're going to come on and take turns asking questions one by one. So without further delay, let's get into our first question from Patrick, talking to us from the Pensacola, Florida area, who's about to ship out to boot camp with an Air Force Special Warfare contract. What's going on, Patrick?
Hey, my question for you is, what were your biggest failures and how did you learn from them?
Yeah. So, do you mean physically, like evolutions, or do you mean like mentally?
Yeah, either way, man, whatever gave you the most challenge and how did you learn to overcome those things? I mean, whether it be mentally or physically.
Yeah. So physically, obviously you want to be running, you want to be swimming. I would definitely get some fins on and just feel it out, see how it's going to hurt those ankles and your hips a lot more than swimming without fins. Just put yourself in uncomfortable situations as much as you can so you can build up that resiliency, right? And then mentally, something I covered on this podcast I feel very passionate about is being selfless. So when you're out there and you start feeling sorry for yourself, just be self-aware and recognize that that's like human nature. That's your mind telling you like, oh, I'm starting to like feel sorry for myself and all that. And that's when you need to take over your mind and be mentally tough and just ignore that. Ignore your body's natural protective mechanism to be kind of selfish and be worrying and know that your body is capable of way more. I'd say mentally toughness. You just got to recognize it. And as soon as you start to recognize the stuff that your mind will just innately want to do, you'll be able to avoid those situations. Keep it in the back of your mind that quitting is not an option, right? Like, don't even have that as a thought. I'm sure you'll crush it.
Yeah, great point, Kevin. Don't focus on not quitting. Never quit, because when you focus on what you don't want to do, that's what your brain and your mind is thinking about. Rather, you should be focusing on the mission and what you want to accomplish. And if you want to further research these concepts, check out target fixation as well as creative visualizations. Okay, next question. We got Peter coming from South Florida. What's going on, man? Go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah. So, and you may have covered this in the interview as well, but, you know, obviously going through Bud's supplementation you're not authorized to do so, but in working up to, and, you know, in our training before joining, what are your thoughts on doing that? Obviously not as a shortcut, but as a way to help with recovery time and make yourself as strong of a person as you could be. You know, obviously it's not sports where we're interested in parity of play. We want to have an unfair advantage on the battlefield. So training and going into that, what are your thoughts and how do people think about that?
Yeah. So my thoughts, you know, like before I went in, you know, I'd use like pre-workouts to get a good workout in and whatnot, you know, get that caffeine boost. But the more you take that kind of stuff, like the more reliant you become on it and the more you think that you actually need it to get a good workout in or whatnot. So eat healthy, right? Eat good meals, get good rest. Like all the vitamins and supplements stuff, you can get that all from just a healthy diet. So I'm not saying don't use pre-workout, because I definitely use plenty of it. But just realize like you can do a lot just being, you know, disciplined and forcing yourself, which is honestly probably goes back to that first question. It's a good exercise of working on your mental toughness is forcing yourself to be disciplined. So say one day you wake up and usually you take pre-workout and then you go hit the gym or whatever. Instead of doing that, wake up, go hit the gym without taking anything and be disciplined to go hit the gym and work out hard without requiring that extra supplement or whatever you think you need.
To caveat on that, when it comes to supplements and pre-workouts, first of all, you're not authorized to use them when you are going through selection. BUDS, ANS, SFAS, RASP, etc. These courses don't authorize supplement use. So one argument could be, if you can't use them during selection, which is what you're training for, then why would you use them at all? Well, these may help you accomplish training goals and get some gains that you may need so that when actually you go into selection and you're not taking these things, you're good to go. You've been training your butt off. You have the motivation of your teammates, the instructors, the course. You don't need any of those supplements. Now, before somebody may go into the military, or maybe you're enlisted right now and you're taking college classes, or you're working full time and you have to work in pool training, running, rucking, weightlifting, mobility, all these things into your day, and you're tired and you want to get a pre-workout in or whatever it is. Yes, I understand that doing it temporarily, if that enables you to crush it in the gym and really get motivated, then it's better to have it than not. And everyone's aware that you can't use it when you get in the pipeline. So some supplements that you may be interested in before you go into the pipeline are things like branched chain amino acids, maybe some creatine, not monohydrate, because that's going to put a lot of water weight on your muscles. It's going to induce cramping and other things. So there are forms of creatine such as micronized creatine that can really help you maybe get one extra rep when you're in the gym, help you with recovery, etc. This stuff doesn't require a loading phase. Branched chain amino acids, BCAAs, these are great for recovery. And the building block of protein, the monomer of protein being the polymer, is amino acids. So branched chains are a focused, concentrated group of amino acids that help you with recovery. Now, be careful when you buy amino acids, because a lot of them have other blends and things like that for pre-workout use and things. You want pure BCAAs in their pure form. Obviously, whey protein is great. A lot of my students, you guys that are listening right now, you've heard me talk about casein protein, which is protein that you can take before you go to bed. This is slow-release protein that will help with ensuring your body is maintaining that anabolic drive while you're sleeping, and it's also going to help you with not waking up super hungry. Your muscles are going to be getting replenished while you're sleeping. Casein protein comes from cottage cheese, actually. So if you enjoy cottage cheese, by all means, no need to buy casein protein. But if you're anything like me and you don't like cottage cheese, casein protein was great for me back when I was training for Division I football or baseball, or of course, before I went in to pararescue. And last thing before we get on to our next question, when I went through the PJ Indoc course, and Buds is the same way, I know Kevin can attest to this, the cadre slash instructors do room inspections. They'll come into your room and kick down the mattress and search everything. All your drawers and your rolled up socks, you name it, they're going to find it if it's in there. So you don't want to mess around with trying to take anything in the pipeline that's unauthorized. For those of our listeners out there taking notes, the best thing that you can do to get motivation, which is temporary, is to find inspiration from within. Find inspiration from within. And what inspired me when I was going through the PJ pipeline and before was imagining myself on this rescue mission. Pilot gets shot down. I'm coming out of the helicopter. We're taking rounds. I got to fight my way to the pilot, and I've got my boys next to me. We're fighting together, and I got my medical ruck, and we're talking to all the pilots, and we're talking to the crows back at command, and we're trying to figure out this situation on how we're going to safely get this pilot out of the wreckage, hoisted up into our helicopter from the side of this rocky mountain, and back to a hospital to some doctors that can save his life and fix his needs. I used to think about that. I used to dream about that. It inspired me to know that after I accomplished my dreams one day of earning that Maroon Beret, becoming a PJ, there were going to be people that depended on me to save their life one day. My teammates, maybe shot down pilots, Marines, soldiers, people that needed me. And I got to work hard right now so that when that time comes, I perform to the level that they need me to perform. If that's not inspiration, I don't know what is. Okay, let's go ahead and go to the next question. Looks like we got Joshua. Go ahead and ask your question.
So after all, I've had lots of setbacks in here. Long story short, I had two contracts to go to Buds, and then got in a wreck. The second time, lost my contract, separated my shoulder. But anyways, I ended up in the Army. A buddy talked me into it. So I joined the Army, and I guess, what's it like working with SF dudes? And I've had a lot of people been telling me, hey, you got to go SF. But my passion and everything I want to do, I want to go to Buds. And I want to go be part of the teams with some of my other boys. So I guess, what's it like working with SF dudes, and how's that?
I didn't work too much with SF guys in my own career. We did some training like ASO, which is Advanced Special Operations, and if I had to explain it to somebody who's not really familiar, I'd say it's kind of like CIA type of training, which the SF guys, I think, do a lot of that stuff, right, Jason? I don't have much to say on that. I did get to see and kind of work a little bit with some CAG guys on one of my deployments, but they seemed like awesome guys, very professional, very good at their job. So, I mean, that's definitely a route you could take. You go CAG, that's an option. Unless you really want to go green to blue, you could always go transfer over and try to get a Buds contract that way. But I'm not sure on how that works. So you'd have to really look into that before you make any big life-altering decisions, you know?
You know, Josh, you've been a part of SOCOM Athlete for years now, and I've had a great time being there along your journey, working with you when you were a civilian, when you barely even knew how to swim at the time, and seeing you put in all this hard work. There's a few things that you should take into consideration. One is that in the special operations community, especially when it comes to things like pararescue or SEALs or Green Berets, they are very unique jobs. For example, PJs, regardless of all the halo jumping, the shooting, the scuba diving, the fast roping, mountain climbing, all of that, it's all based around rescue so that you can save somebody's life whenever they're having a bad day. When it comes to being a Green Beret, this is unconventional warfare, and being able to teach partner forces who are potentially being oppressed by their own government or a terrorist force or whatever it may be. So Green Berets are a direct action unit, but they're teachers. When it comes to being a Navy SEAL, you're looking at doing a variety of operations that involve the water for the most part. And Kevin can touch on this a lot more than I can. But this job is really a one of a kind. The SEAL community, the culture, the missions that SEALs do, and how they launch on these missions, their capabilities. So don't think that you're not going to get the same type of fulfillment by being a Green Beret or PJ or SEAL or some of these jobs that are in the special operations community, but each of them are vastly different. So you originally dreamed as a kid and wanted to be a Navy SEAL. Things didn't work out, and now you find yourself in the Army. You'd like to work your way to the Special Forces Assessment and Selection course to become a Green Beret, potentially. Unless it's absolutely your dream to still be a Navy SEAL, this is your opportunity to potentially do your green to blue transfer. Now, sometimes the hardest thing can just be getting your foot in the door, because going through that administrative process through your chain of command can be really challenging. You've got a lot of paperwork and a lot of signatures that have to be done that are out of your control that take time. So you're already where you're at. My recommendation is to give Special Forces Assessment and Selection the best shot you got. But if it's your dream more than anything else to be a SEAL, you're only young once, man. What are you waiting for? Get after it.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. You know, it all just depends on what you want and what your ultimate goal is, you know. Like I said, like those CAG guys, those Green Berets that are basically the SEAL Team 6 equivalent in the Army, they work hand-in-hand with the squadron guys at SEAL Team 6. They'll sometimes just flop over and be part of a squadron. So that, if you go that route, if you think that might be a better route to take since you're in the Army now, I'm not sure how old you are and the requirements and all that. You just got to know your stuff, but that's definitely an option too.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Kevin.
All right. Great question, Josh. Thanks, Kevin. Next question. Let's go with Floyd, who's talking to us from South Georgia, I believe, just became a member of our SOCOM Athlete Georgia group. How you doing, Floyd? What's going on?
Yes, sir. I'm down in South Georgia. Just joined. Thank you, though. So right now I'm training to be a aviation rescue swimmer in the Navy. I'm in the process of getting a contract. I just went and took a PST 2 weeks ago, and I literally just learned how to swim 2 months ago. So I passed everything except my swim, and I've just been struggling with getting a structure in the pool and what I need to really work with. You know, I've been trying to reach out and look at blogs and stuff, but I'm having a hard time, you know, finding that structure on what I need to do every day. How can I get like the best me in the water?
So first of all, do you know how to do the combat side stroke, like the actual technique?
Yes, sir.
So what I would do is I'd get in the pool every day and just do laps upon laps of combat side stroke. I was telling Jason on the podcast, like my first PST, same thing. I passed everything besides the swim. I went in with regular swim trunks, board shorts, didn't even know what really side stroke was. Pretty sure I had my head out of the water on the side stroke the whole time. Just switching those swim trunks out to something that's tighter, less drag, will literally take off seconds on each lap, which eventually could be minutes, you know? So get some I would say get UDT shorts, because like Speedos are just weird to me. I wasn't a water polo guy or swimmer, so but UDT shorts, that's all you really need. It's something tight to your body that doesn't constrict your movement and it doesn't drag you down in the water. And then the side stroke, just keep practicing that technique. You'll get it. Make sure you're getting long in the water, reaching out as far as you can, getting good kicks, and being calm, right? Like when you're swimming, it's not like sprinting, right? You shouldn't be exerting too much. You should just have better technique, right? And be more efficient with your stroke. That's what I would recommend.
All right, Juwan. So you're in the delayed entry program waiting to ship out for the Navy, which means that you have a developer, you've got guys to train with. There's plenty of videos out there on YouTube, I'm sure you're aware of, so you know the technique. Let's get into the weeds a little bit. What's your times looking like for your 500? Is 500 the only distance you've ever done? Have you ever swam 1,000? Have you gotten the open water? Have you done finning? Let's start with where are you at with your combat side stroke?
So streamline-wise, I feel like I'm really good on the streamline. Me and my developer, we've been working more on freestyle than the side stroke. I don't know what it is, but he said he wanted me to utilize the freestyle more than anything, so that's really what I've been training. Also, I really have a bad problem sinking. Like, I sink at, so I've just been struggling with trying to keep myself, you know, in the groove and going without sinking straight to the bottom. Like, I have no fat on my body, honestly.
Right.
And just trying to get over that hurdle of sinking and staying relaxed in the water. You know, that's really the biggest problem.
Right, right. Slow, easy movements, we call that. So, Juwan, I think you're taking notes. The term to define the problem you're dealing with is called negative buoyancy. That means, for lack of better words, you sink. And some things that you need to take into consideration for your body composition and dealing with sinking in the pool is that you're going to have to increase your stroke count versus other students that you're competing with that are more positively buoyant. So you moving forward is what's going to keep you afloat. Unless you're treading water, utilizing the egg beater kick or frog kick, etc., when you're doing combat side stroke or you're finning or you're freestyling, like you're just talking about, you have got to be able to maintain forward movement. That's what's going to keep you afloat. And the good news is when you get out in the open water, you're going to be more buoyant because of the salt, as well as all of the equipment that you have on, the dive gear, your scuba fins, which in the pipeline are going to be rocket fins or jet fins. So stay encouraged. Keep your eyes in the fight. I highly recommend that if you haven't done so already, you get out in the open water with a buddy, of course, and a lifeguard supervision. Throw some combat tops and bottoms on. Get some rocket fins, jet fins. Make sure you got your booties on your feet before you put your fins on. Get a mask, snorkel, and really get out there and familiarize yourself with the water. being in South Georgia, you're not too far away from the beach. So if you can, get down here to the Gulf Coast of Florida, get some surf in when we actually have waves, really just get some experience and some confidence in the water.
Oh, thank y'all for the advice.
Hey, you know, I got one more thing for you.
Yes, sir.
You got to check the regulations, right? The rules. But something along the sides of being more buoyant too is see if you're allowed to wear like a wetsuit short. Like the rubber wetsuits, right? Those make you a little bit more buoyant. Every little bit could help, right? You're probably going to be wearing a type of rubber when you're actually doing the job as a rescue swimmer too. So it's not like you're really cheating yourself. But even if you get just like a little wetsuit short that you put on as your bathing suit, that's short. But it still provides you a little extra buoyancy, especially around like the hip torso area. Like that can help you out too, as long as it's not breaking any rules.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, for our guy on the call who's at Buds right now, to my understanding, the open water swims are just done with the wetsuit slick. You're not wearing combat top, combat bottom. Would you mind verifying that for us real quick, please?
Just wetsuits for the most part.
Excellent. And what stroke are you guys currently using right now? Just lead arm, trail arm with one arm fixed out front, the other straight down to the side, doing a flutter kick? Or are you guys doing a recovery stroke where you're flutter kicking and getting both of your arms involved, single arm pull? What kind of stroke are you guys using right now?
It depends on the person, but usually side strokes with taut, unless someone's shitty at swimming, and you just grab the other dude by your belt and drag his ass to the finish.
Yeah, guys, to elaborate more on open water swims, you're always going to have a buddy, and you need to be good at finning with your left arm forward and your right arm forward, because when you're finning with your buddy, both of you are going to be facing each other. So if each of you prefer to have your right arm forward, you can't face each other. One of you's got to take one for the team and go with your left. So you need to have experience. You don't want to be slowing your team down because you can't fin both ways. When you're finning with your buddy, one is going to be responsible for navving, aka guiding, and the other one is going to be responsible for setting the pace. So somebody's guiding, somebody's setting the pace. When it comes to doing open water swims, you don't want to be getting your arms involved too much, especially when you have combat top and bottom on, because that's going to cause you to fin very crooked. You're dealing with current and tide and even waves whenever you're in the open water. So it's very hard to fin straight when you don't have lane lines. So it's all about finding that good fixed body position, holding it, and maintaining it. All right, next question we've got. Guillermo, go ahead and ask your question, my man.
All right, cool. No, I was just curious. I kind of had two questions. I'm sure you kind of went over it. I heard you guys talking about motivation. I was in a class, so I joined late. But was going through Buds, you know, was getting through Buds your motivation? Was it to prove something to yourself, or do you feel like that's kind of like the main theme? Or was it out of spite of something else that may have occurred in your life? You know, I could speak for myself where for a long period of time when I was younger, I'm in college now, but when I was younger, I was always kind of last guy to get picked, you know, not the best athlete. No one really wanted to do anything in terms of, you know, sports. I was not the guy you wanted. And for me, I feel like beyond proving something to myself, it's also in spite of all of that. Like, I want to make an achievement to show that I'm more than capable of being the best person I can be, right? Would you say that that was something that got you through Buds, or was that just a small fraction of the motivation that helped you get through your course?
Yeah, I think it's different for everyone, right? But that's definitely something that'll motivate you. And if that's your main driver, like that'll probably help you out a lot, right? Like proving to yourself and not quitting. I wouldn't want to only join like this community just because you want to prove to yourself that you can do it, you know, because then you might not be happy with the actual job, right? Like, oh yeah, you achieved this almost impossible task. But now when you're doing the day-to-day job, like, does it make you happy, right? So I think, yes, it's a great motivator. It's a part of it. Like I said, it's different for everyone, but don't have that solely be your reason for wanting to either be a SEAL, PJ, or EOD or something like that, right? Like, make sure that you actually like the end job too, because it's great to accomplish something like that, and you're putting a lot of time and effort and training into it, and then you get to the job and you just do your minimum requirement and then you get out, right? Which there's nothing wrong with that, but you should also focus on, you know, the end goal of getting that job and actually enjoying it and continuing to grow and love that career path and choice.
Yeah, definitely. That was just something that I was just, you know, kind of curious about. It was in the back of my mind. But the second question is, I have more interest in being a combat controller, just because, you know, I find the nature of that job a lot more interesting, you know, being able to do humanitarian aid, providing, you know, support for different countries. But I was curious to know if, obviously, we're not in wartime anymore, are CCT's capabilities...
Hold on. Guillermo, if you're looking to do combat control for providing humanitarian aid, you've got the wrong career field. CCT dropped bombs on bad guys, ATC, JTAC.
Oh, definitely. I definitely know that. But that's just, you know, one of the small fractions, like, of the mission, right? But obviously, they can do a lot more capabilities. You know, they have capabilities in direct action and their ability to be JTACs, right? So is that still being utilized by the teams today, whether it be in exercises or whatever, since we're not in wartime? Or are CCTs kind of focusing, you know, I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't know that much about the CCT since you're not a CCT, right? You're a SEAL. But I was just curious, are they still being utilized by the SEAL teams?
Yeah. So, like, on my first deployment in Iraq, we did have a CCT that was at our FOB with us, and he did a lot of drops on targets, like ISIS targets and whatnot. I'm not sure exactly what's going on right now. Like, I know we still have presence in Yemen. I know we still have some Marines and Army in Iraq and whatnot. And I mean, if you're paying attention to current events, we could have predicted what would happen when we left Iraq again, with the Shias and the Sunnis and the SMGs, is just Shia militia groups backed by Iran. Like, there's going to be crazy stuff going on there probably forever, that goes down deep into disagreements on their whole lives, right? Like, their religion, it's just like what they grew up in, right? So there's probably always going to be a job for a CCT, even if you're only in a jock. Unfortunately, you're not actually out in the field, but you can still drop from the jock as well in not a full combat environment, right? Like, we're not in right at this moment, but you could still get some work in that route for sure.
Yeah, that was really just my question, because I know, you know, the CCT's bread and butter is, you know, seizing airfields and doing all that. They have a bunch of other things, but what really interested me was having the ability to attach to the SEAL teams, the Green Berets, you know what I mean, working up that way to be able to experience different things.
Yeah, and to explain what I was talking about more, because I'm speaking from someone who's been there, you might not be very familiar, but a JOC is like a joint operations center, right? Basically, you'll have like screens up that have live feeds from drones or other aircraft, and depending on like the state, like my first deployment, we didn't really get to do too much. We were able to advise and assist, but at the time, like, we just got back into Iraq, right? After Obama pulled a lot of our forces out. So most of our support was with partner forces, right? And you weren't allowed to do a lot on that first one. But the CCTs were, you still require like a JTAC or a CCT on those drops, right? So there's work out there for sure. Even in an environment like right now where we're not in active combat.
Okay, thank you.
To give a little bit more insight on this, and if you go back earlier in our podcast episodes, we have Dan Schilling on, who is the author of Alone at Dawn. Dan was a 24th STS combat controller. He was also a special tactics officer. In the book that he authored, Alone at Dawn, talking about the story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman, he was a combat controller from the 24th Special Tactics Squadron at the time that was attached to SEAL Team 6. At the end of the day, he was there on SEAL Team 6 as a support entity. So whether or not you're working with a SEAL team or an ODA, as a 23rd STS combat controller or a tier 1 24th STS combat controller, you're supporting that unit. And what really makes a combat controller lethal and distinguishes them, gives them the opportunity to be attached to these teams, is that they're not just JTACs once they get that qualification. They are air traffic controllers. CCT learned the air traffic control trade in their pipeline. So they really understand the flow and movement of all of these different aircrafts in theater, and they can bring that power of the Air Force to the battle space, being a force multiplier. So that's what makes a combat controller unique, why SEAL teams, Green Beret teams, etc. need them, even though those teams may have their own JTACs, is that a combat controller can really take it to the next level. Okay, next question. Looks like we got one from JJ. Go ahead and ask your question, my man.
What's a normal day in the life like for you and the teams, Kevin?
I said on a podcast, which you can listen to later if you like, but basically, it all depends on where you're at, right? If you're in a SEAL platoon, not on instructor duty, there's a cycle. And the cycle is you go through ProDev, which is professional development, and you go to specialty schools like Sniper, Breacher, even comms, just all these other extra training besides your normal stuff that you'll hit in workup. And you have some downtime too if you get back from the school, just kind of going into the team, getting all your gear ready for workup. Then you go into workup, which is about a little over 6 months, and that's where you hit all the core stuff like land warfare, HRS CAS, so like helicopter. You go to your diving if you're a SEAL, like all that. And then after your workup, you go to more specialized for where you're going to deploy to training, where you do like full-on final training exercises that are geared to your area of operation for deployment. And then you get a little bit of downtime right before you deploy, pre-deployment leave, and then you deploy. And then when you get back, if you're staying with the team, which usually every new guy stays again with the team, you do the same thing over again. It's like a reset button. You go to different schools. You could even be a sniper and a breacher, right? It just all depends on what your platoon needs, what guys stick around, and what guys leave to go either be instructors or other platoons. So it's hard to say exactly what a day in the life is. It's definitely fun. When you're in workup, you know, it's super busy. But when you actually have downtime, you have some good downtime. Like, you really do. SEAL teams really take care of their own, and they expect a lot from you when it's time to show up and shine, right? But then when there's nothing going on, when you got that little bit of downtime, they're really good at not wasting your time and letting you try to make that time back with your family and whatnot. So it's a great experience.
Awesome. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah.
All right, next question. Let's go with Pat.
Hey, I got two quick questions. The first one is, what are you swimming with in prep at selection? Because I'm using my PTUs, my physical training uniform right now. The second question is, I really struggle on mobility, if you had any tips.
So yeah, so first question was, what was I training with, like Buds Prep? Or
what are you training in? Like, what kind of like equipment? Like, are you using something slick to swim in, or are you in PTU?
Yeah, so You'll hit all that stuff in your like uniform, right? Getting comfortable in the water. But all the like the timed evolutions and stuff like that, like you're going to just be, if it's in the ocean, like a timed swim, you're going to be in a wetsuit with your fins and your knife and your belt. No combat equipment yet. They're relatively slick. And then if you're in the pool, you'll have your fins and your mask and your UDT shorts. So that's very slick. So I focus on swimming slick, because you'll get plenty of training like with your camis on, right? It wouldn't hurt to go like just feel it out and see what it's like, because like it obviously sucks trying to swim in camis and stuff, but like you'll get it. You'll get to that level in your workup and in the rest of your training. The second question was mobility. You mean you're just like not very flexible, or what exactly do you mean?
Exactly. I struggle with flexibility, and I've always been kind of a rigid guy, but I just don't know how to fix those issues. Do you have any recommendations on where I should look to
I mean, I would get into some yoga, man. Like, yoga is not only great for your mind, but it's great for your body. Getting those deep stretches in, do some hot yoga too. I love some hot yoga. That'll help you be a lot more flexible, I think. And at the end of the day, like, if your body is just not meant to be that way, just do your best to do those stretches and whatnot. There might not be too much you can do, right? Like, there might not be an answer to that, and you'll be all right, you know?
All right, thank you, sir.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, let's go with our next question. We've got Pete. Go ahead, my man. Ask your question.
Yeah, so, Kevin, you were with SDV1.
I do know some stuff about SDV. I was not an SDV guy. I went out there as a Tradet 3, which is Training Detachment 3, and I was a Land Warfare Division instructor for the SDV guys. So what they do, they, after Operation Red Wing, they made a big move to get all the land warfare type training be run by, like, your land-based SEAL teams, right? Because being out at SDV, like, their primary mission set, very water focused, obviously. And they kind of lose track of those SEAL skills a little bit. The land warfare type stuff, the soldiering. And they made a new requirement that all those instructors were going to be primary land experience SEALs. Obviously we have our water experience as well, but nothing like SDV does. So I was out there for that. Do you have any specific questions about SDV?
Well, that was kind of my question. You know some guys that are in now, and, you know, you just hear about a lot of people trying to avoid going the SDV route if they can, because they'd rather focus on the land warfare. But you get to hear about the SDV guys doing some pretty cool stuff that stays classified. So I was just going to ask, you know, what type of person goes for that, and things to be aware of if that's the route that you know, that somebody wanted to go down.
Yeah. So when it comes to SDV and, you know, where we're at right now, like, it might not be a bad option. Personally, I was never into it. Like, I didn't really like diving that much, and you'll be surprised how many guys that are SEALs that aren't big fans of diving. Even though we're Navy SEALs, and that's kind of where we start our operations, right? A lot of them come from the water, go back to the water, but they're doing some tier one level missions. I can't get in, obviously, too much of what they do, but with the way the world is right at this moment, they're probably getting some good amount of work, right? Doing the stuff they do, because that whole land warfare in Afghanistan and Iraq, like, that's not happening right now, at least for the vanilla teams, as I call it, not SEAL Team 6. And if you're into diving and you like that, and, like, there's plenty of SDV guys that love their job. And living in Hawaii, there's also SDV Team 2 that re-stood up on the East Coast. You could go there. But I honestly, the experience I had in Hawaii, being stationed out there, was life-changing. I loved it out there. It was really, really great experience supporting those guys. So if that's something that you want to do, I would totally pursue that.
So, we have a student from Arizona that graduated the SEAL pipeline. For our listeners out there, after you graduate BUDS, it's called SQT, SEAL Qualifying Training. That's your pipeline before you get your Trident. And after he graduated SQT, earned his Trident, he ended up going to SDV1 in Hawaii, that SEAL delivery vehicle team. And when I hit him up, I'm like, dude, how did you get the honor of being a part of that unit, man? That's a big time tier one level mission. He goes, Jay, I'm the only person on the entire team that volunteered. So the funny thing is, when it comes to scuba diving, as a PJ, we're trained as combat divers very early on in our pipeline. And then when you get to your PJ teams years later, you do quite a bit of diving. And most of the diving that you do, the water is cold. It's at night. Or if it's during the day, there's no visibility. You have a lot of equipment to be accountable for. And that makes it a long day for the setup and the breakdown. All of the team gear, your individual gear. The military can really take the fun out of diving. So it doesn't surprise me hearing Kevin say that a lot of SEALs aren't super into diving. Those of us that are military divers understand that the military loves to take away the fun of diving. Now, you'll be able to have some fun with the boys on TDY, doing some shipwreck dives and whatnot, maybe doing some familiarization with new gear. But for the most part, functionally, diving is not done in desirable conditions.
Yeah, I mean, so when most people probably think about diving, they think, like, you can actually see stuff. Like, but when you're doing an operation and training for a real-world operation, you're doing it at night, right? So it's pitch black. You don't see anything. You're down there kicking away. Your mind's wandering. You got your kick count, your swim buddies, and your dive plan and your little compass, and you got a tiny little chem light glow stick taped to your tack board, which is a board that's got a compass on it. The SDV guys use some other stuff that's a little bit more high speed, but yeah, it's not very glamorous diving, right? Like, you can't see anything. And like Jason said, there's a lot of prep that goes into it, and then a lot of breakdown. And you're cold and wet, you know, even if the water is warm, just being in the water that long, like, you're going to get cold. But like, I didn't hate diving too much. I just definitely was not interested in being an SDV guy and sitting in a submarine for hours on end and transitioning into a different submarine and using all different types of breathing apparatuses. And it just wasn't what I was into. But like I said, a lot of the SDV guys that went that route, they love it. They're really into it, and they're really good at what they do. So if that's something that you're passionate about and would like to try, I would go for it.
Kevin, man, thank you for taking some time out of your day to do this interview and Q&A with us. It's not every day these guys get the opportunity to ask a Navy SEAL some questions. And Kevin, I am excited to have you out as an instructor at our Hell Day event in San Clemente on November 19th. Do you have any closing words for our listeners out there?
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to help, and I hope it was beneficial, and look forward to maybe seeing some of you guys out in November at Hell Day. You know, my parting words would be, try not to overthink stuff. Simplify things, right? You're a lot more capable. Your body's a lot more capable than your mind thinks sometimes. Things are going to be tough, so know that it's going to suck sometimes, but the reward afterward it outweighs way more than the little bit of temporary suck you got to put up with. So if you have a goal and a dream, focus on that. Use that inspiration and motivation, and you will be successful.
Thanks again for listening to SOCOM Athletes Podcast Send Me. This is your host, Jason. Please don't go anywhere. We're asking for your support. If you're listening on the Apple Podcast platform, please consider giving us 5 stars if you enjoy the podcast and a written review, as this helps us get our name out there and gives our podcast more visibility. If you're training for a career in special operations, don't miss our upcoming Hell Day event in Denver, Colorado on October 22nd, open to any and all ages 16 plus that are desiring a career in U.S. special operations. After that, we'll be in San Clemente, California, where Mr. Kevin himself will be coming out as an instructor. That'll be on November 19th. We have the honor of yet again utilizing the basic reconnaissance course facilities over at Camp Pendleton, California. Thank you again for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast Send Me. This is your host, Jason. We are out.
Sound off.
We got you.
Thank you. Up.